Title my talk about ameliorating chronic disease stigma in American public health law. I have no financial relationships to disclose. So public health law and stigma. One of the things I think that's really important when we talk about stigma is to actually get a working definition of stigma. People use the term a lot, including in public health, and I think oftentimes we don't really have a good sense of what it actually means and how it's defined. So this is there's lots of different ways of defining stigma. I take this definition from Bruce Link and Joe Phelan, their sort of analysis of what health stigma is. And it consists of really two phases. The first phase is a difference phase. You have to have an in-group that marks or brands an out-group on the basis of some sort of shared some shared demographic characteristic. So the classic examples would be things like the Scarlet A. I was thinking the Scarlet Letter, right? At least I think it's an A. We don't know, right? Hawthorne didn't tell us. But the Scarlet A or the Yellow Star that Jews were forced to wear during the Third Reich, or skin color, for example, right? Those are sort of ways in which we mark groups as different. That's not enough, though. There has to be a second phase, which is the deviance phase, right? The second group has to be actually, the out-group has to be assigned a negative attribution on the basis of this shared demographic characteristic. As it turns out, there's actually a lot of slippage between those two, especially in context of public health. We're not very good at marking out groups as different without judging them deviant. In theory, they can be separated. In practice, they don't seem to be very separable at all, right? So one of the things I think is really important is to think about law as a discursive product. What does that mean? When I think about law, I think that it sort of really reflects the polity whom is enacting, implementing, executing that law, right? So the classic example I give is capital punishment in New Jersey, which is outlawed, right? So presumably that reflects something about how some people in New Jersey, maybe powerful people in New Jersey, I don't know, right? It's not a perfect representation about how people in New Jersey might feel about capital punishment. When you compare that to Texas, where they have some different views on capital punishment. And full disclosure, I'm actually from Texas, okay? So the idea is that law can actually reflect stigma. It can fuel or intensify stigma. We know that this happens. One of the interesting questions is whether law can actually create stigma where none existed before. I don't know the answer to that. I'd be interested to hear what you think. That's not usually the way it operates. Usually we find that it sort of fuels or intensifies some kind of pre-existing stigma. Okay, so why does stigma matter? This actually poster is taken from an NIH conference on the health implications of stigma that was actually held in 2001, so we've been studying this for a while. The first is that stigma increasingly, the evidence is increasingly getting pretty good that it's independently correlated with adverse health, right? So what that means is that we have a lot of good evidence that even when we control for almost every conceivable confounder, people who are members of groups that are consistently subjected to stigma and discrimination, they get sicker and they die quicker. Basically is what happens, right? There's a very good, if you're interested in this, there was a February 2014 issue of the journal Social Science and Medicine. It's all about structural stigma and population health. It is literally about exactly this issue, the increasing evidence that stigma itself is actually corrosive and is bad for you. And it's sort of not really surprising when you start to think about what stigma is, why it would be bad for you. One of the theories that I'm attracted to, and full disclosure, I'm attracted to it partly because I just wrote a paper on it, right? So further shameless self-promotion. I'll mention another paper I have while I'm presenting the one I'm doing here, okay? Maybe stigma is what's called a fundamental cause of disease, right? And actually, what is a fundamental cause? This is also Lincoln Phelan's theory of what's the criteria for a fundamental cause, but which I'm not going to really go into here, but the idea is that stigma may very well qualify, actually. It seems to be so powerful in its effects on health that it might actually qualify as this really sort of root cause of the distribution of ill health in societies, right? But of course, as Scott Burris has pointed out, it almost, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but even if stigma wasn't corrosive and bad for health, we might still say it's ethically pernicious, right? We probably shouldn't have it in a just social order. I was attending Ron Bayer's talk yesterday. He thinks that stigma actually might be tolerable in a just social order. So there's room for some disagreement. This is phrased more as a question. But I think we have grounds to really doubt that. He may be right, but I'm dubious, and I know Scott Burris is dubious as well, right? So where are we with public health law and stigma? Almost all of the work that's been done on public health law and stigma has focused on HIV and AIDS and sexually transmitted infections. And that's understandable, right? I mean, for a variety of reasons, given the nature of infectious disease and communicable disease, how readily stigma, it seems to be an axis for many kinds of stigma, both past and present, is not really surprising. And I'm not actually even criticizing that's where the emphasis has been. But the problem is that if you look at what the disease footprint is in the United States, it's about 80% chronic illness. We are a nation of chronically ill people, at least when we start to talk about domestic health, right? And so The fact of the matter is most of what's killing us and is what's making us sick is actually not infectious disease, which isn't to say infectious disease is unimportant and we shouldn't talk about it. It's just it's a lot of other things, right? So if we're really going to allocate resources based on what's really causing these sort of this distribution, right, the actual disease burden, we would want to sort of think a little bit differently. And one of the sort of interesting things that I've found is the only illness paradigm for which we actually have good data on disease stigma is HIV and AIDS. We have absolutely no good prevalence estimates whatsoever for almost any other kind of disease stigma that we have in the United States. Now, we do have good evidence for fat stigma, and I'll talk about that in a minute, right, and why I sort of include that here. But most other kinds of pain stigma, most other kinds of stigma, which includes pain stigma, which I'll also talk about, we don't have good prevalence estimates. We don't even know how much there is. All we have is good ethnographic studies, right, good qualitative studies, and all the evidence suggests that in many disease paradigms, disease stigma is actually rampant. It seems to be pretty common. At least that's what the informants suggest and they represent, but we don't really have any good way of quantifying that. We don't really even know how much there is. I want to suggest that's actually part of what I'm talking about, right? It becomes almost invisible to us. We don't see it even though it's everywhere, right? So what are some examples of the most common illness experiences? Well, far and away the most common illness experience in the United States and probably in the planet is pain. I think there's the widely bandied estimate of 116 million chronic pain sufferers. Some people don't like that number. I think the debate over whether or not that number is accurate is sort of a little bit precious because it doesn't really matter if it's right or wrong. We know that pain is overwhelmingly common and by a large margin is definitely the most common disease experience in the United States, whether it's 120 million or 100 million or 80 million, whatever it is, right? So pain, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, cancers, we have pretty good evidence in the literature that stigma can attach to all of these kinds of illness paradigms, but we really don't have any estimates of their prevalence, and not just prevalence estimates, we even have less analysis of the way that legal pathways can enact and can intensify the stigma, which I think is a pretty serious problem. So why do I have fat stigma in parentheses? Well, fat, contrary to what the American Medical Association says, fatness is not a disease. At least we don't get to call it a disease because the AMA thinks that it is, right? Disease is socially constructed and we get to decide what's a disease and what isn't, and that's why those definitions and parameters change over time. So why do I include this in an analysis of chronic disease stigma? Because there's a variety of reasons that I'll talk about a little bit later, but it's often, it can be operationalized as part of this because it's so, as a quote-unquote risk factor, it's so closely attached to many of these kinds of illness experiences. And in fact, when we ask people who have, for example, type 2 diabetes stigma, what are they experiencing, often what they will refer to is fat stigma, right? So fat stigma, we do have some actually pretty good evidence on how widespread that is, and unsurprisingly, the evidence suggests it's rampant. It's rampant. It's absolutely everywhere as far as we can tell. Okay, so let me give you guys some examples of how law can actually mediate this kind of chronic disease stigma. So the one I'm most familiar with is pain. So claimants seeking Social Security benefits, they have to prove that they have a physical or mental impairment, and it has to result, and here you go, from anatomical, physiological, or psychological abnormalities, have to be shown by medically acceptable, clinical, or laboratory diagnostic techniques. Physical mental impairment must be established. Here we go. I know this is dry stuff, right? But here we go. Medical evidence consisting of signs, symptoms, and laboratory findings, not only by the statement of symptoms. So what's the problem for people who experience chronic pain? There's the problem. Your statements alone are not enough to establish that there is a physical or mental impairment. What's the problem with chronic pain? Well, look what the American Pain Society says. And this is just illustrative. Almost every pain management organization, not just in the U.S., but in most of the Western world, says that the patient's self-report is the single most reliable indicator of pain. A clinician needs to accept and respect this self-report absent clear reasons to doubt. We have a problem, in case you can't tell, right? Because there's a lot of people who experience chronic pain who are disabled for a variety of reasons, right? A lot of people who seek Social Security benefits are actually chronic pain sufferers. And the problem is that their very ability to narrate their own experiences, which is actually really important for clinically treating them adequately, is the very thing that the law tells them is going to be discounted, is going to be delegitimized, is going to be invalidated. It is not sufficient. So there's lots of different ways of thinking about this. But in going back to our definition of stigma, I think it's clearly marking out a group of people because this law does not, even though it's not targeted at pain sufferers, it does not affect everybody individually. Somebody who has a solid tumor, for example, and is claiming disability benefits under Social Security is going to have much less of a problem satisfying the standard than people who experience chronic pain, who are going to have a huge problem experiencing. So it's marking out a group of people, chronic pain sufferers in particular, although there might be other ones that it's marking out as different as well. And it's suggesting that there is something deviant or lacking about the condition that they have, right? There is something that is inadequate to meet the standard necessary to get disability benefits. So there's lots of other ways of thinking about this. Javi Carrell writes about something called epistemic injustice, right? The idea that we are basically transgressing by robbing people of their ability to narrate their own illness experiences, which is exactly sort of what's happening here. Their own ability to voice what's happening to them and what they're experiencing is actually invalidated and undermined and delegitimized by the law itself. Right? So I think this is a pretty good example of how stigma is instantiated in law. There's some good work on this. It's also highly gendered, to be perfectly honest with you. Dara Purvis has a nice article on how these particular regulations actually disproportionately affect women, for example, who claim benefits on the basis of fibromyalgia. They're never going to be able to meet these standards, and the evidence is pretty clear what happens to them when they try to go through the Social Security system. So it's gendered, and it's stigmatizing. So other examples, type 2 diabetes. So this study literally came out last week, I think, 10 days ago maybe. 67% of Native Americans, and this is a recent study, this came out of Oregon, reported experiencing healthcare discrimination in type 2 diabetes. So I looked at this. I mean, this is a qualitative study. We're not talking about huge numbers again, but 67%, that is a large number. That was my reaction when I saw that, right? Major forms of this kind of discrimination include employment discrimination and fat stigma. Is discrimination stigma? That's a complicated question. I can't get into that here, right? I think it can be, for purposes of this, it's close enough that we can sort of think about this. There are multiple cases, and I did a very cursory search in the legal literature. It's very clear. It's all over the American Diabetes Association's website. They have a good compilation of cases as well. Multiple cases affirming the risk of uncontrolled diabetes and the plaintiff's responsibility to control their diabetes as a justification for termination. Those ideas of responsibility become pretty important because, for example, in the literature on fat stigma, we know very well that people who are more likely to adhere to these personal responsibility means are actually more likely to stigmatize fat people as well. And this has been shown. That actually predicts fat stigma pretty well. So I think one of the ways to think about this is chronic disease stigma in public health law as hegemonic. What does hegemonic mean? Well, this is, again, from Scott Burris's taxonomy of disease stigma in public health law. Hegemonic stigma is accepted as natural and sensible without reflection. It's often seen as invisible, right? It's just sort of, we don't even really think about it. It's just given the standard. And here's a really neat example of this with type 2 diabetes stigma. So Australian healthcare providers in 2013 said that type 2 diabetes was one of the least stigmatized conditions. They said, we may have some problems with disease stigma, but this one is really sort of low down in the hierarchy. So then what do you think happened when we asked Australian type 2 diabetes patients? Not we, because I didn't do it. Right? 93% of them, this study also came out about 2 weeks ago, 93% of the participants reported experiencing type 2 diabetes stigma, basically. Right? So you have this total disconnect where it seems as natural and sensible a state of affairs about the world that's totally invisible to the practitioners who, let's be honest, are at least part of the people who are involved in axes of stigma against patients who are reporting, who are experiencing type 2 diabetes. Right? So this is what I mean by hegemonic stigma. Chronic disease is so common. Chronic disease stigma in various forms is so common we often don't even see it. I'm going to run out of time, I think. Okay. So, two quick things. So, one is, I'm an ethicist, and I think it's really important to think about normative frameworks for public health law, which I sort of agree with Professor Smith. I think we probably don't do enough of, to be honest with you. One of the things I focus on is Powers and Faden's health sufficiency model. I like to look at inequalities that fuel densely woven patterns of disadvantage. What does that mean? It sort of refers to the epidemiologic fact that social disadvantages tend to cluster, and that if you're a member of one group that experiences social disadvantages, you're also likely to experience other social disadvantages at the same time. So the twin aims, what are the two things we should strive to do in our public health laws? We should try to improve overall population health, and we shouldn't try to compress health inequities. The panel presentation I was part of on Monday, we sort of talked about the idea that it's actually harder to do that than we think at the same time. Most of our public health interventions actually do not maximize both of those. So the point here is that laws and policies that intensify stigma, they fail both prongs. Thank you, Professor Smith, right? They fail both prongs, okay? Not only are they bad for you in terms of overall population health, but they actually expand inequities, and this is the sort of last really important point I'll make, which is that because stigma tracks social power structures, members of disadvantaged groups are already more likely to be stigmatized than others, right? So if we intensify disease stigma, chronic disease stigma through public health law, that stigma is not going to be equally distributed. It's going to be most likely to be visited on groups who are already stigmatized, who are already disadvantaged in many different ways. So this is not a good thing. I don't think we should be doing that, okay? So this is sort of, I'll just, this is the last slide. So fortunately, here's the bad problem is that stigma is so intimately connected to social power structures, we can't just, we might have to sort of radically transform our society in order to fix it. That's the bad news, okay? The good news, however, is that there's actually a lot of more sort of micro anti-stigma mechanisms that have been actually shown to have some effect. Some effect. It's modest, okay? I'm not going to say that this is going to solve our problem. It's not. But there are some things we can do which actually help, short of Viva la Revolucion, to be example, right? So the example that I give here is, type 2 diabetes stigma was such a problem with regard to employment discrimination that the ADA, the American Diabetes Association, its advocacy groups, they stood up and demanded that the EEOC basically do something about it. And if you go to the EEOC's website, they have now detailed guidelines, a really, really excellent report that makes very, very clear what you can and what you can't do in an employer in terms of people's rights who have type 2 diabetes, right? So it can be named, it can be identified, it can be made visible, which is, I think, one of the things we really have to do when we refer to chronic disease stigma. So I'm going to stop there, and I look forward